It's Chatter on Books, and if you think this introduction is boring, you try writing the copy. I'm Jamie McIntyre. Here's Tori Clark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. Hope you're doing well. Hope if you're maybe in one of those small parts of the world where it's not 9 billion degrees and you're doing well. In just a little bit, fingers crossed, we'll be talking to Zane Asher, who we thought we had a few weeks ago, but she got sick. But now we have her back, we hope. This book, Where the Children Take Us, and with a few weeks' reflection, I'm even more impressed by this book. It is a memoir. It's a tribute to her mother, to a wonderful love story, to Nigerian culture. It's a fabulous book. So we're going to talk to her. But first, we have Lauren Larson doing the wonderful work as Claude and Family of Believer in North Carolina. Wishing them the best. David Aldridge from Nat Stadium with us. And our favorite mayor, Judd Ashman. Judd, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Thank you. Judd and Jamie filled in. I think, David, you were Las Vegas first time we
saw Summer League, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Judd and Jamie and I just started riffing, filling in. It was kind of a fun show.
Absolutely, as it always is without me, I'm sure.
So, David, this is Chatter on Sports. We have to ask you about Bill Russell.
Sure. I mean, whatever you want to ask me is fine. I mean, there aren't enough superlatives to describe his impact. And I'm not even talking about the basketball, which was seismic. We kind of have created an entire hero industry out of Michael Jordan, which I get, by the way, because he was great. Michael Jordan won 6 NBA championships. Bill Russell won 11. In 13 seasons. So, I mean, you tell me who the bigger winner was, you know. So he was a remarkable force in all things, and much more so off the court even than on the court. And he was substantial on the court.
I mean, there's no one else like him. I mean, to say he was a giant in so many ways, to your point, set aside the basketball career, which was stunning. I just kept hearing more facts and figures over the last 24 hours. 21 games in playoffs that were all or nothing, and he won every single one.
Yes.
Basketball itself was extraordinary. He was just a team player, which I love, which nobody is.
Yeah.
But it was like Arthur Ashe. It was almost what he did off the court was more important than what he did on the court. And I
always
got the sense he was one of those people who got it. He loved the game. He clearly loved the game. But he realized there were more important things going on in life, and he leaned in.
I think that's a great comparison that very few people make, Tori, is that like Arthur Ashe, Bill Russell was an incredibly successful athlete who also jumped into these very turbulent waters at very turbulent times. I mean, you think about Arthur Ashe refusing to play in South Africa, just won't do it. I won't do it. They're offering me a lot of money. I'm not going to do it. In the 70s, not when it was chic to get arrested from the South African embassy in the 80s, no, this is when almost nobody knew about apartheid, you know, in the United States anyway. And for him to have that kind of principle, and for Bill Russell to have the kind of principles that he showed in the 60s, not now when it's a lot easier for athletes to take stands and to be active, when it really was costly. You know, he was the most important player on the best team in basketball. And said, I don't care. I'm going to tell you that I'm not going to play in these games in the South where I can't stay in the same hotel as my white teammates. Not coming, you know, and that carried so much weight, you know, back then when it was so important. You can't even fathom the impact that that had.
Do you think, David, that the lessons of Bill Russell, given that he played so long ago, I mean, his playing career ended before I was even born.
Sure.
And do you think it resonates with today's everyday NBA players? You know, do you think he's part of their consciousness?
To some, yes. I mean, there's, you know, with time, everybody has kind of diminished. You know, there are people who denigrate the players in Bill Russell's era because there were only 8 teams in the league back then. And so a lot of people would say, well, who is he playing against? You know, janitors and busboys and, you know, bus drivers and things like that. He wasn't playing against players as good as us. There's some truth to that. on the other hand, he had to play Will Chamberlain basically every week. So because there was only eight teams in the league. So, you know, he played the greatest players of all time much more than great players play one another today. So I think to most players, they understood. You talked to LeBron James and Kobe Bryant before he passed away, and all of the, I think most of the iconic players of this era, they all had reverence for Bill Russell and understood the impact that he had and understood the demands that he made of white America to recognize his humanity. So he was powerful, I think. And again, I think much more so for what he did off the floor than what he did on the floor. And what he did on the floor is unparalleled.
Two of my favorite visuals that I just watched endlessly this weekend. One was when he took a knee, Colin Kaepernick, he took a knee, and he was older, and he's a guy, and he had to, it was a physical effort as much as an emotional effort to do that, God bless him. And then when Barack Obama gave him the Medal of Freedom, and he had to really duck down, so Barack Obama, who was not short,
correct,
the ribbon around his neck. I love
it. Yes. Yes.
It seems almost unfathomable that you're playing Wilt Chamberlain every week, but perhaps he's not your most formidable adversary. Maybe it's racism in Boston and racism in America. I mean, he was fighting the fight all over the place.
And you mentioned, Judd, you mentioned the this in Boston. I mean, I think it's a very famous story that he bought a house in a white neighborhood in Boston, and people broke into his house and defiled it. I mean, and unspeakable things that I'm not going to talk about on this podcast that they did to him, did to his home. And, you know, he didn't hide. And when people would knock over his trash cans, he went to the police and said, people are knocking over my trash cans. And the police said, well, it's probably raccoons. And it happened again. And he said, well, why don't you give me a permit for a gun so I can shoot the raccoons the next time I see them? And nobody knocked over his trash cans again. So, you know, in real time, when it mattered, you know, when it was important, he was on the right side.
Yeah, he was something. All right. Thank you, David. Thank you for you.
Sure.
A little book news. So it is one of my favorite parts of the summer. Former President Barack Obama comes out with his summer playlist, which I didn't pay much attention to, but his summer reading list, which I did pay attention to. And I didn't realize at first that it was divided between fiction and nonfiction, but I was really happy to see that The Family Chow by our friend Sam Chang from Iowa Writers Workshop is phenomenal. Family Chow, David, how did she describe the book? Succession in a Restaurant, I think is what she said.
Right. That's right.
Razorblade Tears by Sean Cosby.
S.A. Cosby,
Cosby. And Judd, you can talk about him and his Pope-like appearance at the Gaithersburg Book Festival. Another fabulous book. And then in nonfiction, Chris Herring, who has Blood in the Garden. And all three of them, fabulous. And I like to think, I realize when famous people put out these lists, they tend to be heavily curated and developed by multiple staff members and, you know, worked and reworked. But I like to think of Barack Obama reading Donnie Walton's book, reading Sean Cosby's book, reading Sam Chang's book, reading Chris Herring's book, which are fabulous. But you guys, are you influenced by endorsements like these? Judd first, then David.
Sure. I look at Barack Obama's list. He always has a good list. And frankly, when I saw this and I recognized the three authors have been on this podcast, I developed this theory that President Obama must be a regular listener.
Must be so. Must be so.
You know, people have reached out a couple of times, Judd, but I'm like, come on, maybe this one.
So, Mr. President, if you're listening, I want to be on the panel when you show up. Mm-hmm. But there's another book I wanted to call out on that list called A Little Devil in America in Praise of Black Performance by a guy, I'm going to butcher this name, but I'm going to try, Hanif Abdurraqib. And I read it a few months ago, and I thought it was spectacular. It was a bunch of essays that are cultural criticism about black performances in black culture, but also memoir. He breaks that wall. It's a really interesting book. So I think Barack Obama put together a terrific list here. And of course, Sean Cosby is amazing. Everyone should read Razorblade Tears. We say that every single episode I'm on.
I love to. David, are you influenced by endorsements by famous people? Because you're on famous people all the time.
Sometimes. If it's someone I respect, and I know that they, to your point, they may have actually read the books, and it's not just some PR person telling them about this book. But certainly someone like the former president would be someone whose opinions. I'm just so happy that our authors are blowing up. It's just, isn't that wonderful?
It's pretty wild. It's pretty wild. And Sam Cheng, that's a part-time job for her, is actually writing, because she runs the Iowa Writers Workshop. The more we learn, the more it's a full-time job plus. And then she's doing that on the side. I think Family Child might have taken her 12 or 13 years, I think she told us. But I think that's fabulous. I one time worked for an executive, and a couple of us were preparing him for some stupid interview. And it was one of those things where, you know, they'd ask, you know, if you were a tree, what kind of tree would you be? And I said, you know, they'll ask you, you know, what are your favorite books? What have you read recently? And he looks up and goes, what should it be? It's like, oh, God help me. God help me. That was the beginning of the end. Okay.
There we go.
Keeping in the news of our favorite authors and Chris Herring, Spike Lee is making a docuseries about Blood in the Garden, Chris Herring's book about the Knicks in the 90s. Mm-hmm. It's also fabulous. And Chris kind of hinted at that at the end of the show when we had him on, saying, there's something in the pipeline here. Can't tell you right now, but congratulations to him. So, David, my recollection of that book and the story is they never won the NBA championship.
That's correct.
But they were a no-holds-barred, we'll-do-whatever-it-takes-to-win team in the 90s. But what was it so profound about that team in the 90s that caused somebody like Spike Lee, who knows what he's doing, to say, that's worth – because it's not The Last Dance in which David
Austin
was featured.
Right.
You know, how much they won. This is a team that didn't win ultimate championship.
Right. No, fair question. I think it was their style, first and foremost. Incredibly physical team. Their mantra was we're going to foul you every time and dare the referees to call it. And as you know, the referees don't want a game to go 4 hours. They let a lot of stuff go. And that's where they were going to let stuff go. So, but Pat Riley is a very charismatic leader, very, you know, just out of central casting type of leader, you know, and, you know, Patrick Ewing was a Hall of Fame level center, and they just had really strong-willed physical people. And so it resonated. If they played, honestly, if they played in Cleveland, it probably wouldn't have been a book, but they played in New York. So everything kind of gets outsized because it's in New York. You know, they're worth it because they were a very worthy team. And their stories are very compelling because it's very hard to get people, a team, to commit to playing defense every night. Very difficult. Hard, because it's hard to play defense. So to get them to do it for multiple years, and they competed as well as anybody did against Jordan's Bulls teams and had a chance to beat him a couple of times. So I think that there's something to be said for the worthy adversary that doesn't quite break through. We loved Amadeus because it was told by Salieri, right? I mean, it wouldn't have been as good as it was just Amadeus telling his own story, right?
Has Spike Lee reached out to you yet? Will you be in this series?
I doubt I'll be a part of this series. Although Spike and I have a very good relationship, I'm sure he has other people that will be in this series other than me.
But my recollection is Spike Lee was one of those celebrities who started the whole courtside seat celebrity thing, but it was L.A., right? Wasn't the Lakers?
Well, the Lakers were among the first with Diane Cannon and people like that in the 80s. But I will say this, Spike came to this honestly because he started in the highest seats in Madison Square Garden, the 500-level seats that you need a Sherpa to get up to when he was a nobody. He had season tickets up there, and gradually – as he got richer and more famous and more able, was able to get better and better seats.
Yeah,
yeah, but he earned his way down.
All right, Judd, I want to ask Judd about the Miami Heat, but have I ever told the story about my father and taking him to the baseball games? This is so great. My mother, back in the 50s and 60s, worked for the Pittsburgh Pirates. She worked in their press office and did all this great stuff. And so she knew baseball. And when we were little and growing up, she would take us to baseball games. My dad was always working. And she knew how to keep the scorecard or whatever. And she knew you buy the cheapest seats. And if it was the middle of the week or something like that and the place isn't full, then you work your way down. You move to the seats that aren't being filled.
Right.
It's just what you do, right? So that's what you do. So decades go by. My mother, God rest her soul, goes off, you know, over the Rainbow Bridge, and we're bringing my dad down here all the time. We're going up there to see him, and we take him and some others to a baseball game. I guess it was an Nats, must have been the Nats, and go to the baseball game. We bought the cheap seats, and it was the middle of the week, and the seats down in the field level or whatever you call it were completely empty. So the kids and I look at each other and okay, let's go. We start to move, and my dad goes, "What are we doing?" I said, "We're going to move to better seats." And he goes, "We didn't pay for those seats." And I said, "Yeah, we're moving to the better seats." He wouldn't move. He wouldn't move. So I have three young children screaming, going, "We got to get down there before the fifth inning or whatever." And my then 86, 87 year old father just refused. And so kids moved down. And I mean, the worst mother and daughter in the world. Kids moved down, and I split the distance between them, like three seat rows from the, you know, field. And my father up in, you know, those section, I would kind of run back and forth checking on everybody.
Outstanding. That's so great.
So Judd, you're a Miami Heat fan. What would the series be? Who do you want doing a docu-series on the Miami Heat? And what's the story?
Well, first off, this has become chatter on sports fan ethics. I like it. And I'm not watching that series on the Knicks unless David's in it. So, you know, tell Spike, you better get
Spike, if you're listening.
Who would do a series? Who would do the documentary on the Heat? That's a good question. There's a lot of
Michael Mann.
Yeah, exactly. Michael Mann and the score, the soundtrack would be DJ Khaled. You know, it'd be or Pitbull or, you know, something crazy like that.
Yep, that would be pretty great. And by the way, Judd, I think you're dating yourself with some of those names. My 20-somethings go to Miami every once in a while, and I just don't even want to hear the stories that they come back with.
Well, those are the guys that sit at courtside in Miami.
Right. Yeah. You know, yeah. But they're all these.
It's Jack Nicholson in L.A. It's DJ Khaled in Miami.
And Jimmy Buffett.
Yes.
Oh, aren't you cute? You both are talking older than I am. Okay. Okay. So I did our authors. I did Chris. Did Miami.
You wanted to do the quiz guy, right? Or the class guy. The guy
we'll do the math guy, but Judd's got an author he wants to pitch. And yeah, Judd is a local guy.
Well, he was local. Now, this is a guy. So David talked about how nice it is to see your authors blow up. It's wonderful. And having been doing the book festival, the Gaithersburg Book Festival for 13 years, I've seen a lot of that over the years, and it makes me really happy. One of the guys... was this 10 years ago, this prodigy author. He was 28 at the time. His name is Anthony Mara. Mm-hmm. And he had this book called, it was a novel called A Constellation of Vital Phenomena, which is, I realize, mouthful. Great book. It's probably my favorite novel of the 2010s. And I've read quite a few, so it's saying a lot. It won some awards. It got some critical acclaim. And then he followed it up a few years later with a book of short stories called The Czar of Love and Techno, another mouthful. But I think he's really sort of rising. He grew up in Chevy Chase, but by the time he was at Gaithersburg, even at 28, he was teaching at Stanford in the Wallace Stegner program. He was pretty respected. And now he's got a new book coming out this week called Mercury Pictures Presents. It's a novel that's set in the community of European exiles of war during World War II, who made a home in Hollywood in the 1940s and created the art and expressed the ideas that they could not in their home countries. And based on the reviews, it's super funny and moving, a terrific piece of historical literature. He's going to be at Politics and Prose on Wednesday in conversation with our friend Angie Kim. And I will certainly be there. I wanted to invite anybody who wanted to get to know a great author to come join us at Politics and Prose.
Fabulous. He got a great New York Times review. I think they called it elegant, compelling, all sorts of things. So he's a Landon kid. I mean, lived in Chevy Chase, went to Landon. You don't have a lot of great writers coming out of Landon, so good for him.
Yeah.
I'm so happy to see we've got Zane Asher joining us. Hello, Zane.
Hi. How are you, Victoria?
Welcome to Chatter. And across the top, we have your little pictures. I don't know what it looks like on your screen, but my Lauren, who does all the important work and makes this thing run, David Aldridge, and Mayor Judd Ashman from Gaithersburg. Everybody say hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
We are so glad to have you with us. It's a fabulous book, Zane. Oh my God. It is fabulous. And it is, It is so unlike what I thought it would be. And I was saying to Judd before the show, it's interesting with a few weeks perspective, because I did lots of reading. And I just watched lots of your interviews and read the book a couple of times. And I had all these thoughts and all these questions. And then with a few weeks perspective, I went, wow, this is, it's a love story, your parents. It is the story of a remarkable mother, absolutely remarkable mother. And it's this great tribute to Nigeria. Three things in one, each one of which you could have gone down, you know, for hours endlessly. But let's do a little bit of your backstory, because you speak three or four languages. You went to some, you know, okay schools. you know,
I like that sort of thing.
Okay, average, you know.
Yeah. Average. You're top of the charts on CNN. I tend to watch CNN International and listen to it more than anything else. So I've been following you for a long time. Great interview with the woman from Nigeria who won the gold medal at the track.
Yes.
Fabulous. Fabulous.
So inspirational.
It was inspirational, but also the two of you talking about Nigerian parents, which was great. And you have three incredibly successful siblings. What can you not do, Zane?
Oh my gosh. What can you not do? Well, first of all, I mean, thank you so much for just such an introduction. And thank you so much for reading the book. And I'm so touched that it resonated with you. When I wrote the book, I was sort of, at first I thought to myself, okay, you know what, maybe this might resonate with Nigerians. Maybe it might resonate with people who are interested in Nigerian culture. So just to sort of see how wide of a net this book has cast, just in terms of the people who are interested in it. It is really, I find that so touching. And most importantly of all, you pointed out that, you know, the book is not just a memoir, it's also a tribute to my mother, but almost equally as important, it's a tribute to Nigerian culture. And I really feel that Nigerian culture is misunderstood. It's certainly overlooked. You know, not much is known about it here in the US. I mean, I think the UK is a little bit different because there are so many Nigerian immigrants, because Nigeria, of course, was a former British colony. So a lot of Nigerians who migrate to the West tend to go to the UK. But in the United States, not much is known about Nigerian culture. And so I thought to myself, wow, if my book is the first experience people have, you know, the first sort of glimpse into Nigerian culture that people in America get, what do I want to say? You know, and I really sat and thought about that. And so just to hear your response to it, it's really meaningful for me.
And your mother, I mean, I know it's a bit of a cliche in all of your interviews. The title is Where the Children Take Us. It was Where Does Mom Take Us? Stunning. But start with the love story between your mother and your father, who were what, 14 when they met and fell in love? 14, 15 years old, very young, right?
Yeah. So my parents fell in love, met, and then fell in love just before the Biafra War broke out in Nigeria. The Biafra War, for people who don't know, I would say still is one of the sort of deadliest, most brutal, most vicious sort of civil wars on the African, if not the world, in history. 2 million people died. Starvation was used as a weapon of war. And the reason behind this war in Nigeria was really that part of the country, the part that I'm from, the eastern part of the country, wanted to break away from the rest of Nigeria because they felt they had been sort of mistreated. They wanted to form their own independent state. And so my parents met just before the war broke out. And unfortunately, right when the war broke out, they were separated. They weren't really able to see each other for 2.5 years. My mother's family sort of packed up and went to different villages and towns across the eastern part of Nigeria, hiding at times behind enemy lines, just trying to shield themselves from the constant shelling and mortar, and really just trying to. And my father's family did the same. But my dad, being 16 years old and very adventurous, and obviously having just fallen madly deeply in love with this young girl, really decided that he was going to try to track my mother down during this war. And so he sort of hitched rides with strangers traveling from town to town. And you've got to understand that in Nigeria, communities are very sort of close-knit. It's very, it would be a lot easier in a place like Nigeria to go from town to town, you know, tracking down one person that you know and asking them, hey, listen, what do you know about the young girl from the Okafor family who fled to this particular town? Have they been here? Communities are very sort of close-knit. Uh-huh. Where my dad is from in Nigeria, the village he's from is very, very close to my mother's village. It's almost the same sort of umbrella village. And so he was able to travel, you know, to various towns throughout the eastern part of Nigeria searching for my mother. And, you know, sometimes he would arrive at one village and they would say, oh, you just missed them. They went to this town and then he wasn't able to track them down there. So he asked somebody else. And eventually, 2.5 years later, he ended up in a place called Olo. And my mom and her family had gotten there a few weeks or months before that. And my grandparents on my mother's side would often start these sort of makeshift restaurants in towns where they set up shop. Yeah. So my mother was serving at her parents' sort of makeshift restaurant, and she saw a young man come in. She couldn't really see who he was because his back was to her. And she sort of walked over to him and planned to take his order. And then he looked up and it was my dad. And after 2.5 years of basically searching for from town to town, he finally tracked her down. And it wasn't long after that proposed to her, and they set off together to Europe, first to Paris and then
it's an incredible story. It's an incredible love story at the best of circumstances, and they made it happen through the worst of circumstances. David and then Judd, what's the hardest pre your current significant others, who are spectacular of course, what's the hardest you ever worked for somebody with whom you thought you were in love?
Not that hard.
David, for you, it was like maybe 2 subway stops. If you had to go 2 subway stops.
Oh, my then girlfriend, now wife, drove several hours, like 9 hours to see me one time, which I thought was the
coolest. Oh, that is so sweet. Yes. You see, that is.
Yeah, but there was no war involved. There was
nothing like that.
That's not nothing.
She got in her mid-80s car and drove 6 hours.
Judd, anything? Any really extraordinary efforts?
Similar. Not that, like David said, not that good. But I met the woman who would become my wife in Miami, moved to D.C., and, you know, I traveled a lot to see her after we started dating. But that's the extent of it. That's,
again,
no war, no threat.
Economy plus in American Airlines, Judd. I mean, you're not suffering. I was telling somebody the story today. My parents met in Pittsburgh and they dated briefly. My mother was beautiful and gorgeous, and my dad was the nerd of all nerds. He gets sent in the army to the Philippines, the end of World War II, and they're writing letters. And I still have a lot of the letters they sent back and forth. They essentially dated via these letters. And at some point, my mother, like waking up going, I want nothing to do with this knucklehead, stops responding to his letters.
Ooh.
And he panics. He's in the Philippines. It's been 2.5 years. He panics, and his buddies, who are far cooler than he was, said, oh my God, no, you've got to talk to her. You're no fun. You got to talk to her and you've got to propose to her because you're going to lose her. And so he wrote a letter to his father. His mother had died a year or two before. And he goes, I want you to go over to Seal's house. That was her name, Cecilia, on such and such a day at such and such a time with mom's ring. And he set up a ham radio call. All his buddies helped him pay for it. He set up a ham radio call to call her, and he proposed to her over the ham radio. And his father put the ring on her finger.
Wow.
Now, two things. Again, it wasn't difficult, Zane. It was not. He wasn't quite it's the only romantic thing he ever did his entire life. And I asked my mother once, you know, 30 or 40 years later, I was like, what the hell were you thinking? She goes, I was too shocked. She goes, if I hadn't really thought of it. Okay. So got the love story. It gets you to, I mean, this is a terrible segue, but your parents go to the UK. They go to England and they're setting up a business and a pharmacy and they're trying hard. And really what I think inspired, motivated, drove your mother to this incredible story is a terrible tragedy. So I hate to make you revisit it, but can you tell us what happened and why your mother found herself with these insurmountable odds?
Yeah. So basically, you know, my parents were really the loves of each other's lives. And I know that you know, a lot of people say that, but my dad was really the only man that my mother had ever had hands with, had ever kissed. You know, he was her everything. And as they navigated life in the UK together, he was really her rock, because it was a very difficult transition for my mother as a young sort of, was it in her early 20s or late teens when she moved to the UK. And so my dad was her everything through that. And so my dad and my older brother go on a road trip, and the road trip's in another country. And my mom is at home one day, and she is waiting for my dad to call her. And she's expecting my dad to say, "Hey, listen, we've landed back at Heathrow Airport, can you come pick us up?" And my mom knew exactly what time the plane was supposed to land. So she actually got ready, and she was waiting for the phone call to say, "Okay, you can leave now." And the phone call never came. And she was waiting for 5, 6, 7, 8 hours, just sort of fiddling her thumbs and just trying to do anything to occupy her. And all of a sudden the phone rings at around 6:30 in the evening. She rushes to answer it. She expects it's going to be my dad, and she's ready to give him a piece of her mind. Like, "Oh my gosh, I've been worried. Obviously their flight was delayed. Why didn't he call me to at least let me know?" And the voice on the other end of the line was not my dad's. It was the voice of an extended relative in Nigeria where the road trip was taking place. And the voice basically said to my mom, "Your husband and your son have been involved in a car crash. One of them is dead, and we don't know which one." Mm. And everything for my mother just froze in that moment. You know, she describes it as an emotional earthquake, and that is really the best way to articulate it, because she ends up going to Nigeria. And as she's on the road to Nigeria, there's so many feelings and emotions swirling around inside her, because on the one hand, she understands that obviously something catastrophic has happened, and she technically has no idea who she's going to be burying in her family, whether it's going to be her husband or her son. But there is another part of her that's very aware that this is Nigeria it's the 1980s, and there's obviously no cell phones. It can be quite a chaotic country, it can be quite disorganized. There is a part of her that is clinging to the hope that maybe the person was confused, and maybe they were both injured in a car accident, but they're both okay. Mm-hmm. But she really is on this sort of 6-hour flight to Nigeria without knowing. And that is really the hardest part. And she gets to Nigeria, and she's told what happened. And my dad and my brother were traveling from a place called Enugu to Lagos, which is supposed to be a 6-hour drive. And somewhere sort of closer to Lagos, the person driving my dad and my brother the opposite lane to cut traffic. And as the car went around this bend, you know, there was a blind spot, mm-hmm. and the car my dad and my brother were in was crushed by a tractor trailer. And everybody in the car was killed instantly, apart from one person in the back seat where my dad and my brother were. And that's why there was so much confusion. And because it looked as though everybody had died on the scene, people in my family and in my village were initially told that there were no survivors. Then hours later, other members of my family were actually told that actually, no, the little boy might have survived, but other members of my family had been told that everyone was killed. And so they were actually still trying to work out what actually happened when one relative called my mother and told her, because it had been a day. So my dad died on September 3rd, but my mother wasn't told until September 4th, because there was just so much confusion. And then eventually it was like, we just have to tell her what's going on, because it's been 24 hours.
Oh. So the small miracle is your brother survived, but your mother had to leave him there, right? Because he was in such terrible physical condition. Having going through the trauma of losing your husband, and your son is desperately injured, but she has to leave him there because he's so badly injured, but she has to get back to the UK, right?
Yeah, so we all went to Nigeria for the funeral. So my mother was pregnant with my sister at the time, but she had 3 children. So me, my eldest brother, and my brother on the road trip. And so we all went to Nigeria for my dad's funeral. My brother, Chuatel, was still in the hospital. He could not attend the funeral. And the doctors, after the funeral, you know, my mom had to get back to the UK. Obviously, She had two other children who were in school, and she had this pharmacy that she was running, and she couldn't keep it closed. And there's all sorts of sort of concerns. I was 5 years old. I was about to start school for the very first time in my life. And so I ended up starting 3 weeks or so later than I was supposed to start because of what happened. But it was a really difficult situation because the doctors warned that my brother, who was in the car, really shouldn't be moved given what he'd been through with this accident. And they weren't sure how long it would take him to recuperate. So my mother made the decision to bring us, me and my eldest brother, back to the UK, have us sort of get settled there, and then go back for my brother and just have her own mother and her father, my grandparents, and all of her siblings just make sure that my brother was okay. But she, you know, he was recovering at the time, but just moved.
Okay, so for those of you who can't see, I'm watching David and Judd right now, and we're all three of us are going, we're going to quit bitching about the traffic in D.C. We're going to, you know, quit complaining about the gnats. I mean, it's just, it's phenomenal what you and your family went through. And, you know, we could go on for hours, but so your mom makes the conscious decision back to the UK. This is where we're going to plant the flag. This is where I'm going to raise these four children alone. And I'll probably regret saying this. She becomes the tiger mom of all tiger moms. Is that right? She decides that she is going to have discipline and organization and focus unlike anybody else. But there's a Nigerian streak to this. So can you explain that? I mean, she just seemed to make a conscious decision at one point.
Well, yeah, I mean, there were a few factors. So, I mean, after we came home after the accident, my mother was obviously inconsolable. She would just lock herself in her bedroom and scream and cry for hours on end. And that's what we would hear. And we wouldn't really see her. And so she would come out maybe once a day, make sure there was food for us to eat. And then she would just lock herself in her bedroom for what felt like days at a time, literally. And she was just this broken shell of a person. And then my eldest brother, Abinze, ends up getting expelled from school. And, you know, he was 14 when my dad died, and it was just such a difficult thing for him because obviously you're transitioning from boyhood to boyhood. You need a father figure there. The relationship between a father and son is so sacred, especially at that age. And, you know, he doesn't really have a mother or a father at that time. He's not sure how to deal with his emotions. He ends up rebelling in school, shouting at teachers, insulting them, getting into fights and getting expelled. My mother, as a Nigerian immigrant, I mean, the only reason why you up and leave your country, generally for a lot of immigrants, I think it's fair to say, is to give your children a better education, obviously to have more economic opportunities, but one of the bigger things also is to give your children a better education. And so my mother felt that, you know, the one reason why she was in England in the first place, she was failing at. And I think she also felt that she really wanted to make my father proud. You know, they had so many dreams and aspirations together. They wanted the best for their children. That's why they moved to the UK. And to see my brother Abinze, who was, by the way, a straight A student prior to this, be expelled, it was really difficult for her. So something really awoke in her through all of that. And she decided that she was going to do anything to keep my brother away from the streets. He had all these sorts of influences that maybe weren't the best of influences, to be honest, that my mother wanted to sort of protect him from. And also she had to find him a new school. And so she decided at that point that she was going to keep all of us focused on anything besides the empty chair at the dinner table, anything besides pain, loss, grief. And, you know, she rolled up her sleeves, and being the sort of tough Nigerian mother that she was, she made academics and studying a big focus. And so that's when she started the family book club, for example, where she would make my older brothers, I was very young at the time, but she'd make my older brothers read one book a week, usually the classics. And they would have to discuss it around the dinner table. When I sort of was 7 years old, and I was also, even at the age of seven, I had a hard time in school with fitting in. And obviously it was hard for me. The way I sort of processed my dad dying was, I thought to myself, you know, and I can remember thinking this, that like, I get that my dad has passed away, but I don't understand why he's not here to play with me. That's how I sort of reasoned as a five-year-old. And I also struggled in school. I mean, I wasn't doing my homework. I had no sort of parental figure to guide me. And my mom got sort of some complaints from my teachers, even at that young age. And so she goes to my teachers and she asks them for my school syllabus for the entire year. And she looks through the school syllabus and she figures out what I'm going to be learning in school in, say, a month or two from then. And she decided she was going to teach it to me ahead of time so that by the time it came up in school, I would have already mastered it. So if there was timetables on the syllabus, learning in, you know, I was going to be learning that in October or whatever, she would teach it to me in so that when it came up in school, I knew it inside out. And that really changed my entire school trajectory, even as a kid, because my teachers who I wouldn't say that they sort of, you know, were, I mean, I sort of felt quite overlooked, I would say, as a student at that young age. And now they began, after sort of doing so well, they began to sort of treat me as a role model, because no matter what they taught me, I already knew all the answers. And they thought, wow, this child is so intelligent. She's a genius. And it wasn't that. It's just that everything that came up in school, my mother taught it to me beforehand. And that made a world of difference for my...
I tell you, when I was reading that in the book, I was like, oh my God. And I checked in with my three children who are 20-somethings now. And I was like, did I ever do anything like this? And they're like, no. I was the parent who at 3 o'clock in the morning would wake up and go, oh, you know, Colin, sixth grade at the time, has something that's due at 8 o'clock this morning. I'm sure he hasn't finished it. I mean, that was my parenting. I'm just, and your mother was working 12, 14 hours a day running the business. And she still had the time and energy for the books of the week to get months ahead in your syllabus. Where did she find the energy and what she, you know, what was she on? Because we would love to have something that was.
You know what it is? So I talked about this in the book. So yeah, she was working 10-hour shifts at the pharmacy. But because she had lived through this Biafra war, they had to eat snakes to survive, you know, starvation was the weapon of war of choice. My mother ate snakes to survive. She ate termites. She ate crickets as a... She was 14 when she met my dad. So when the war broke out, she was sort of 15, 16 years old. And so she also wasn't in school for 2.5 years because all the schools in the eastern part of the country were closed because there was a civil war happening. And so what my grandmother would do was she would sort of find a clearing in the bush and she would teach her younger children what she thought that they would be learning in school if the war hadn't broken out. And so she would start with sort of very basic maths for the younger kids. But for my mother, she would sort of hand my mother donated books. There were all sorts of donated textbooks because obviously people knew that there was a war happening in Nigeria. And so she got her hands on those. But there was a real focus on just because you are not in school, that does not mean that you are not going to learn. And I'm going to make sure that, this is for my grandmother, I'm going to make sure that you still continue to learn so that by the time the war is over and school reopens, you wouldn't have lost that much academic knowledge. And so then when the war came to an end in 1970, my mother went back to school. She ended up taking her final exams and she actually got the highest grade ever for a woman in our village. And people around us were sort of like, my gosh, how is it that this young girl who had missed almost 3 years of school, how on earth could she do so well? And it's because my grandmother, despite the war and despite her kids not being in school, made academics a dominant focus. And so that's where my mother got the idea from.
So it was in your mother's DNA.
It was in her DNA because she'd experienced that, you know, she sort of thought how she could apply it to me as I was struggling in school, that she could just teach me what I would be learning in the future ahead of time. And, you know, it made a world of difference, really.
Okay, David, and then Judd, because I have so many things I want to ask about. And I promise we would respect your time, but I want to ask about the TV being cut off. I mean, the payphone, about your being sent back to Nigeria. But David, over to you, my friend.
Oh, so I just wanted to ask you about how your mom cut the day out into 3 8-hour shifts, which I think is phenomenal. So you had eight hours to work, 8 hours to sleep. And what were the other eight hours for?
Yeah, so she had this whole, my mother was very conscientious about how we use our time. You know, she was just sort of obsessed with it. She just felt as though, she just didn't fall for this idea that people who got into Harvard, Yale, and Princeton were geniuses. She just did not buy it. She just thought...
She was right about that, by the way. She's very right about that. Yeah.
And she just thought that this is really about, it's not about intelligence. It's about how people use their time effectively. And whether or not you can, a person can eliminate distractions in their life and focus squarely on their future goals and their future ambitions. That is what determines success. And so she had this whole thing about what she called the 8-hour rule, where she would make us divide our day into three equal parts. Obviously, the 24 hours in a day, she'd make us divide it into three equal parts. And she'd say, right, 8 hours to be spent sleeping, 8 hours to be spent in school, and the last 8 hours of your day should be spent working towards your dreams. Because she sort of thought, listen, everybody in the world sleeps for 8 hours. Generally, everybody in the world is at work or at school for 8 hours. So the only thing that can set you apart is how you spend the last 8 hours of your day. It's not about intelligence. It's about using the last 8 hours of your day effectively, and just sort of, you know, putting it towards your dreams, making a deposit. You know, she'd refer to it as a deposit towards your dreams. And that she was convinced that it would pay off.
And she was right, Judd. You're sitting there in awed amazement, I can tell.
Yeah. I have so many things I want to talk about too, but I realize our time's limited. One of the themes that really resonated with me in this book, as mayor of a place, was this idea that you're not only working hard for to satisfy your personal ambitions and to achieve for your family, but this idea that you're representing your village. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So I think that one of the differences between, you know, just having grown up in the UK and also lived in Nigeria as well, is that, you know, there are certain societies that are a lot more individualistic. And there are societies that are much more community oriented. Nigeria is one of those societies that is extremely community oriented. I talk about in the book this idea that I remember just being in awe of this when I got accepted into Oxford, and I found out that people in my village, 4,000 miles away, had a party in my honor. There were people who were jumping on top of cars, drinking into the night, celebrating my achievement of getting into Oxford University. And I remember just sheer disbelief that people, I could not believe that people who I had never met, people that I had never shaken hands with, could be so happy to see me do well. And that really moved me, because I had never experienced anything like that. And so, you know, one of the things about Nigerian culture, just to sort of give you an example of the community spirit, is that in Nigeria, we have these things. Well, this is my tribe particularly. We have these things called marriage sponsors. And that is, this is just an example of the community spirit. When a young couple gets married, you know, the newlyweds will be appointed sort of an older couple who have been married for, let's say, 50 or so years, to sort of help guide them through married life, to show them the ups and downs of married life. This is what you need to watch out for. This is what can really test a marriage. This is what it's like when you have a first child, and some of the difficulties in navigating that experience if you're a newly married couple. This is how you work through it. So that is something that is like embedded in the culture, this idea that you have this older, sort of seasoned married couple who've been together a long time to help a young couple that they don't necessarily really know, you're just part of the same village, to help a younger couple, you know, navigate themselves through married life, because married life has its challenges. And so this is this idea in Nigeria that you're never alone. You're never alone. You always have an entire community of people behind you, cheering you on, rooting for you, wanting you to be your best self, to live up to your highest aspirations. Because ultimately, if you're successful, whether it's in career or in married life, the entire community thrives. You know, your success is my success, you know. And so people are really for each other in a way that I think that, you know, I wish the world had more of that, you know. I wish the world had more of that. Because sometimes I'll tell my mom, you know, mom, guess what? Somebody at CNN, this person at CNN just got promoted. Isn't that great? And she'll be like,
that's amazing.
She'll like, great. You know, hyperventilate with joy. And I'm like, mom, you realize that I didn't get promoted, right? I'm talking about she knows. She's so happy. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like this is what makes, you know, Nigerian culture so special, you know, because there's this idea that, I mean, on the one hand, it's this idea of the sort of community spirit, but it's also this idea that, yes, you know, if this person succeeds, I'm so happy because I believe that if they've done it and they're from my community, that means that I can do it too.
Yeah. You know? So, tell us about, I promise we'll let you out. tell us about your mother sent you back to Nigeria at a pretty, as a teenager, pretty challenging time.
I was about 9 years old.
9 years. Okay. Even more challenging, but tell us why she sent you back and what the experience was like.
Yeah. So in Nigeria, there is just a common belief by a lot of Nigerians who end up giving birth to their children or raising their children in Western societies, that it is a good idea at some point to send your child or children back to Nigeria to live by themselves without you with extended relatives. So I lived with my grandparents. And this is something that is not unique to my mother at all. Very common among Nigerians. I mean, if you ever meet a Nigerian, you can sort of ask them whether their parents did it to them or not. Some people choose to do it, some people don't, but it's a very, very common practice. And it's this idea that when a child is sort of sent back to Nigeria at a point where they're still malleable to live, it will foster a resilience in them that, you know, unfortunately, you know, Western society, like, can't. And, you know, when you get sent back to Nigeria after living in the UK or the US, you will probably for the first time in your life as a child have to fetch water from a stream. That's your drinking water. You will have to live at times without no electricity in 100-degree weather. You know, because some places, some houses have TV, some don't, but you can't really rely on TV for your entertainment because you never know when electricity is going to get cut out. You also have to wash your clothes by hand. You will at probably once or twice experience having to catch your own food. It's not necessarily that common, but, you know, I did it once while I was in Nigeria. I'm sure other people have done it more than once. And so it's this idea that if you can learn to sort of survive that, it will foster in you a deep resilience that can really help you navigate any challenge you encounter in the Western world. And there's also this idea that, quite frankly, I don't know, I'm trying to think how best to say this, but, you know, in Nigeria, this idea of sort of talking back to your parents really doesn't exist, to be perfectly honest. And so a lot of Nigerian parents fear that if they don't send their children back to Nigeria, that sort of culture of speaking back to your parents and talking back to them and being rude to them and not listening to the adults around you might sort of have an influence on their children. In Nigeria, we do not do that. So when my mother tells me to do something, there's no sort of if, buts, well, I don't want to, why should I do that? Well, I'm not going to listen to, we don't do that. And that is what the shipping back is supposed to continue to foster, this deep respect that we have for our elders and the reverence.
Okay, two questions. How much did you hate it? How much did you hate being shipped back? And now with all the perspective, how much did it help you?
I found it really hard. You know, I lived with my grandparents. So, you know, obviously I love my grandparents, but I really wanted to be back in England. I mean, I didn't like the idea of, remember in the school I went to, if you got caught talking in class, one of the punishments was to clean the toilets. And cleaning the toilets in a place where there is no running water is an experience I do not wish on anybody. And I had to do that at 10 years old. And trust me, I never spoke in class ever again after that. And so, you know, I didn't enjoy it, you know, at the beginning. I got used to it towards the end, but I really didn't enjoy it. And also this idea of like turning on the faucet and no running water coming out, you know. I remember when I eventually came back to the UK after about 2 years, I literally have one of the first memories I have after moving back to the UK was being in my mum's house, turning on the faucet in the kitchen, seeing running water coming out, and me thinking to myself, oh my God, we have running water. My mom is so rich. My mom is loaded. We have running water. And that gratitude, it's interesting because one of the effects you asked about how it's affected me and how I look back at how it's helped me. One of the things that experience has done for me now, more than 20 plus years later, is that I have a deep sense of gratitude for the opportunities that I have living in the United States and living, having grown up in the UK. Like, I do not take it for granted having, you know, I'm now about to become American citizen, having that blue passport. I do not take it for granted at all. The opportunities that come from that, the way I get to write my own future because of it, I will never take it for granted, having lived in that kind of environment. And that is another thing that the shipping back, the idea of sending your child back to Nigeria for a couple of years, is supposed to also foster in you. That when you leave that environment, as beautiful as it is, we love the community spirit, but obviously opportunities there are limited. And you come to the US or the UK and you truly realize just what you have here. This country is obviously not perfect, but you realize what you have here in terms of opportunity. And you, 9 times out of 10, will promise yourself and you will make a vow to yourself to never, ever waste it. And that, I think, is probably the biggest thing it has done for me. Just knowing what I have, living in these two countries and vowing not to waste those opportunities. And so,
which you haven't. And I don't, this is the Zane Asher story. It's the Zane Asher book. But your mother didn't just do well with you. You've got an Academy Award nominated brother. You've got a sister who's a doctor, brother who's a very successful business entrepreneur, right? In my family, it was who spent the least amount of time in jail. That was like how we ranked. But I'm going to spare Zane 60 seconds more because it's just too embarrassing for someone who has such an incredible story. But Judd, you first, and then Dave, you have one quick question before we go. And then I've got one question to get her out on.
Well, I just, this is not really a question. It's a comment about this very comedic moment when your mom had recently come over to London from Nigeria, and she was trying, in an effort to connect with her classmates, she thought if she would go see the movie, the James Bond film, Live and Let Die, she could come back to class and talk about it and have this great connection with her classmates. So she goes, she wasn't familiar with American film so much or with Western cinema, and she comes out with 3 takeaways. Okay, 1, Roger Moore is very good looking. 2, New York City is really dangerous and full of crime and drugs. And 3, the actual plot of the movie was incomprehensible. And you know what? She failed in connecting with her students or with her classmates because they were rude to her and she was humiliated. But the fact is, she was right on all 3 counts. Absolutely right.
Last question or comment?
No question. I'm just an awesome
okay. So Zane, again, my friend Jamie Sterling is the one who told me about your book, Zane, and I will be forever grateful to Jamie for doing that because it's fabulous and it's inspirational. And to Judd's point, it's funny and it's just, it's remarkable. But your mom was one tough mom. I mean, I'm just in awe of her. It's beautiful, by the way. I've seen some pictures. Absolutely beautiful. What kind of mom are you?
I would say that I'm probably more my mom than not. However, I'm also aware that I'm raising kids in a very different environment and under very different circumstances than my mother was, you know, when she raised us. And, you know, my childhood was really all about sort of survival, study. My mother, who had lived war and having eaten snakes to survive and having lost her husband and love of her life and being pregnant at the time and raising four kids, a single mother. It's a hard life. And she was really determined to make sure that we sort of aspired to a better life than what she could give us under all of those circumstances. And so for me, obviously, you know, I have a good job. I'm an anchor at CNN and, you know, I'm married. I have a husband who is extremely helpful and very involved and very loving, etc. And so I'm trying to sort of strike the right balance. I will say that I am definitely more my mother than not, you know, because what my mother did for us, even though it was difficult at times, it ultimately worked. I mean, I remember holding the Oxford acceptance letter in my hand after she sort of banned me from watching television for about 2 years. I know it's so funny because it's like my mother is so sort of quiet and sort of demure and sort of really sweet, but like she means business when it comes to sort of like raising kids, you know, and people, it's sort of people, when people meet her, it's sort of hard to make that connection. But I remember holding the Oxford acceptance letter in my hand and seeing the words, you know, it is our pleasure to welcome you to dot, 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 dot. And I remember just that feeling of knowing that my life had changed. The fact that I, you know, a young Black girl, child of immigrants, Nigerian, had been accepted into one of the best universities in the world in a country that, by the way, has a very rigid class system. Yeah. I knew that it was going to dramatically change my life. And I also knew that I had my mother. I knew that if my mother had made different choices, that I wouldn't be going to that university. And when you are a young Black girl that doesn't have or didn't grow up with much in terms of finances, going to Oxford changes your entire life. It changes your entire life. And so with that knowledge, it's going to be hard for me not to incorporate a lot of my mother's strategies with my own children. Because I know what it did for me. But at the same time, I am aware that they have a much easier life, to be honest, than I did. So
when you install a payphone in their bedrooms, I want you to let me know. Just send us a little text, a little email, because that would be fabulous. That's one of the stories, people. She installed a payphone to keep saying.
Well, it was like a small,
a tiny payphone. Yeah.
It was one of those small, I don't even know if you can get in America, actually, but in England, you could get these very small residential payphones. And I've never seen them in America. I've only seen the sort of big ones, you know, you see on the street.
Fabulous. Okay, I really think when you come out with the paperback edition, and I realize there's a fabulous story behind why it's called Where the Children Take Us, but it really should be Where Mom Took Us.
A lot of people say that.
She was phenomenal. Zane, thank you so much for joining the show. Fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. I really hope everybody gets this book from their favorite independent bookstore, because it's there's something there for everybody. Really, it's a love story of so many kinds. So I hope everybody reads it. But thank you for being with us. And wish you the best and come back, okay?
Thank you, Victoria. Take care.
Take care. David, Judd, Lauren, thank you very much, my friends. We'll see everybody next week. We'll check in with another author who's too smart for this show. Thanks, everybody.
Sure. All right.